Blog Talk Radio.
Streams of water in every quarter, to every end of the, to the all four corners of the earth. From the Alufa Sholom, the master of the universe, to the earth and the seven heavens. We're now broadcasting live because we're staying alive with the blessings of the Most High in Torah Chaim. Instructions of life toward chesed, instructions of kindness toward rachamim, instructions of mercies. You're now tuned to blogtalkradio.com, and we humbly suggest we are the higher inner frequency. We call ourselves Soul Class. This happens to be Soul Class number 630, Secular by Design, program presentation number 71. Baruch Hashem blesses our Creator. Shalom, peace, and bracha. Blessing upon the human family experience with Creator's help. We're now broadcasting on November 2nd, 2016, live from Turtle Island, a.k.a. the USA, Unified Soul Actualization. Program content will focus on reading from Alan W. Cecil's Secular by Design, a philosophy of Noahide laws and observances, which can be purchased via the following link, www.goodreads.com/book/show/18126658. Or you can just type into Secular by Design by Adam W. Cecil into any friendly, internationally, local, cyberspace, internet search engine. This is a pretty impromptu show, but if any of you would like to call in to give some additional feedback, aside from our co-host tonight, Dennis Ryan and Alan W. Cecil, it's 347-838-8669. Meanwhile, may the Eternal Creator bless and protect you and your loved ones. The tags for tonight's program are Blessed Souls, Eternal Creator, Divine Image, Universal Redemption, last but not least, Children of Israel, working with the children of Noah to remove hatred, jealousy, and competition not needing upon this blessed earth. But in order for us to get on with the show, we're going to have to remove or reduce the sound of the relaxing sounds for your mind, cascading water. This is a website on YouTube produced by Sounds by Night, which sounds all right to me, by day or night. Okay, let's just turn down the music and let's bring in our co-hosts. And before we even do that, I just want to mention tonight's program is dedicated to the elevation of my dear father's soul, Reb Shlomo Yaakov Oliver Shalom. May he rest in peace. Ben Chuna David, my grandfather, may he rest in peace. And now live with me this evening are Rambam student teacher and disseminator of the teachings of the Nesher Gadol, Rambam, Maimonides, Rabbi Moshe Maimon, Dennis Ryan. Good evening, Dennis.
Good evening, Don, and everybody who's listening.
And complimenting Dennis. And the author of the book we're reading from tonight is Alan W. Cecil, live from Florida, the Sunshine State. And Alan, before we get into the program, aside from your giving us greetings, the gas fire in Alabama, is it having any effect on the coastline, the coast between the border between Alabama and Florida?
I don't know. I'm really far south in Florida, thank goodness.
Right. It just on the spurs of, you know, Alan, we did a program the other day based on one of the 17 resolutions of the UN formulated in 2015 of clean and accessible energy. And we talked about, unfortunately, the pitfalls of fossil fuel. And one of the initial reports I've been hearing since the accident occurred, which I think was either yesterday or Sunday it started, is that it's going to jack up the gas prices. One person has passed on. So, of course, condolences offered to that family. And one more thing, just to go back to our 629th program, again, investigating the one of the 17 resolutions by the sustainability for the, you know, promoted by the UN, is that I mentioned a Dr. Chauncey Kepfer. The name is Kepford, because I went to one of my father's old blogs, And it was Dr. Chauncey Kepford who, in fact, discovered that there was excess radiation coming from the Three Mile Island nuclear power plant. I just wanted, as an addenda to the Sunday program, that independent readings by radiation chemist Dr. Chauncey Kepford found extremely high readings 25 miles downwind the stricken plant of Three Mile Island. There were no official meters to take readings downwind of the plant. Officials don't know and don't want to know. That much more was released from the partial meltdown than they will ever admit. Dr. Kepford, unfortunately, was eventually fired from his teaching position at Pennsylvania State College. And, Alan, before we go into the book, you know, there are so many things to talk about from your book, but in terms of your understanding of the Noahide law, because I know in Torah law there's something called the sabbatical year where old debts are absolved, and if a person sold his land in the land of Israel, for whatever reason, he gets it back. But in terms of financial damage and physical injury inflicted one or the other because of carelessness or business mishaps, there's no grandfathering out of the damage caused. I'm just curious, you're taking this from the seven Noahide commandments. Is there, say, after a certain amount of years, there's no longer any liability?
Not that I'm aware of. And doing that kind of damage, we have a legal system that protects the wealthy corporations, the wealthy energy companies, but it is a violation, you know, to doing harm to someone else, doing harm to, you know, property, other people. They would be held liable, whoever did it. You know, going back, talking about history, in 1889, are you familiar with the Johnstown flood?
No,
I am.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
There was a horrible flood in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, I think it was May 31st. And what it was a lake that was like a resort for Andrew Carnegie and all these rich people. The dam was really was substandard. It was not kept up. And during a heavy rain, it broke, flooded, and killed like 2,000 people downstream. And
wow.
They tried to sue the people, you know, the rich people. And, of course, it went nowhere in the courts. They were found not responsible, even though they were totally responsible. But, you know, it's the same thing. You know, you go like up to Three Mile Island. Oh, you know, that's not our fault, or, you know, I don't know. It's just when it comes to our court system, the people with the money and the power, such as a huge energy company, can keep lawsuits from happening. And, of course, under a Noahide legal system, this would not happen.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Now we're going to get a little bit more theological, but I think it's important, even though the program that we did on Sunday, unfortunately, there was miscommunication with myself and Dennis. He was not able to come on, and I'm very happy you're able to participate tonight, Dennis, that we want to promote the idea, Blessed Souls, that a Torah perspective combined with a secular perspective or any perspective, human perspective, is like 360 points to the circle of life. Okay, I, as a Torah observant Jew, will not back away from the idea that I think that all answers can be found in the Torah, but how the answer comes out in the end, depending on who discovers it, that's another story unto itself. So when we look at the Torah tradition and how it was adapted, and the original Christians were in fact Jews, who, for whatever reasons, which one you can do your own research on this, decided that they want to make their own interpretation. But from there, when these teachings came into the hands of other individuals outside of the nation of Israel, other interpretations were added, and other interpretations, until the point where we reached to page 139 in Alan's book, and the idea of Gnosticism. And maybe we'll ask Alan, and you're also welcome to chime in, Dennis, and the idea of Gnosticism and how it's had an effect beyond religious content, and it affects the way people for the last 1,700, 1,800, maybe even 2,000 years have looked at what we would call the Bible. So maybe before we go further, Dennis, your take on the concept of Gnosticism, then we'll go to Alan, and then we'll start to pick up from page 139 in Alan's book.
Well, I'm still, my mind is still being turned around by what you said the last time with Alan. Two very strong ideas came into my head as you were talking. Only I tried to yell it out, but I wasn't connected. But I heard the last 15 minutes of your program. So the one thing that gets me, and what happens here in America, the home of the free and the brave, is that we have changed some of this beyond what other civilizations have done as they got further away from the Bible. And the one thing we did was we said that every individual has the right to happiness, blah, 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 blah. And we based it on our original documents that started this country, individuals. But what we managed to do with capitalism is sort of thwart the whole idea of the individual, because we created a convention called entity. Now, the word entity has been around for a while, but what we did was, and I don't know if it's in Alan's book or not, it's that we created an entity that each person is an entity by themselves. But capitalism said, oh, yes, well, so is businesses or corporations. They are entities by themselves. So here we are in America equating humans who have consciences and souls with corporations, because it fits into the capitalistic concept. But corporations do not have consciences and they don't have souls. So what happens is the individual idea has now been distorted a bit from what we learned originally in the Bible, that each person was responsible for their action. But when you translate that here into the convention of corporations, and I love capitalism, but the idea is that a corporation has no conscience, and it's not responsible really to anybody other than a government that arbitrarily set up the rules for taxes, money handling, etc.
Thank you, Dennis. Alan, you take on the idea of...
Dennis, have you gotten a copy of my book yet?
No, I haven't, and I'm honest, but I'll admit it, that I didn't...
You need to get a copy because I cover that subject extensively in Chapter 6 about
how... Have we ever said on the radio before?
How corporations were given a legal status of a person in Santa Barbara versus the railroad. It was back in 1886. They became, as you said, an entity, a person with the rights given to individuals. And I cover that very extensively in Chapter 6.
More power to you, Alan. But the Johnstown thing was a disgrace, because it was an earthen dam that was set up to please a bunch of people who were on the high side of the dam. What they didn't worry about is what was the safety of the people downstream from the dam. So,
they should have been held responsible. You're right.
The earthen dam was a great cheap way to stop water. But the problem is, how do you keep the water out of the earth that was holding the dam up? So it's a question of time, gravity, and nature, that if you get too much water in a earthen dam, it's just going to push forward as though it's mud. And that's what happened, and that was one of the greatest American tragedies of so many people died. And it didn't have to be, but it was the way it was. And the people on the downstream were basically miners all over the place, and they were so busy, they didn't worry about the dam till it was too late.
Gentlemen, I'd like to redirect us back to, and I thank both of you for that very potent commentary. I'd like to get both of your gentlemen's viewpoints to review for our listening audience. The great majority will be listening to the archive version, the idea of Gnosticism, before I go further into Alan's book. So, Dennis, your take on Gnosticism.
Narcissism is basically somebody saying, I know. What happens is it's almost like the enlightenment of man, that man by themselves, with their using their mind, they know. But what do we humans really know? In and of ourselves, we weren't born with it. We had to learn. So if you get your ego out of alignment and you say, well, I think I know enough about this to tell other people I know. Well, if you keep going around saying I know, a lot of people are going to believe you. So Gnosticism was a time and place where things were happening, but it wasn't organized. There was not an umbrella. There wasn't any policing in what people were saying. Not policing, really, but directing. In other words, when the early Christians were created or evolved, if you want to put it that way, the only thing they were missing that made them made everything work under Judaism was that you had rabbis. Now, you had people who said, I know, and they all came forward, and the other people who didn't know listened to them. So we even have that as remnants today. I think I explained it one time, the Coptic Church believes in St. John more than they believe in Jesus. Why? Because they sort of took closer to the writings of St. John, and they stuck with it because he knew. So we have even in Greece and in other places of the world where the certain saints are still designated as a source of knowledge and everything there is to know about life. So we have this based on the people who said, I know, I know, I know. What they're missing is they know because God helps them to know. So if you don't have God behind you, what do you know if it's devoid of God? So some people, this Gnosticism was created because the original people who started Christianity or evolved with it were not trained in theology. They weren't trained in a whole bunch of other things. So they weren't using the Bible per se as out in front and following it. They were picking up things along the way and saying, mm-hmm. I know, I know, I know. And this lasted for centuries and millennium. And it's still going on today, where we have somebody that pops up and convinces other people they know, even though they don't. And that was one of the things that the Rambam wrote about in a part of Arabia, Yemen, where there was one guy that says, I know, I know, and he was really pretending to be, not. He believed he was a false god, a god, but he really was a false god pretending that he knew everything. So what happens mm-hmm. is the Rambam had to answer letters from people saying, should we believe this guy or not? Is he real? Can I trust him? And the Rambam had to say that, yes, you'll have many false gods in front of you, but you must believe in the original God and what you were taught while you were growing up. And that's what we're missing today sometimes in the world that we exist, because we keep picking up on things. I mean, how many people followed Hitler because he said he knew? What did he know? It added up to ashes. That's what he knew about. He didn't know much more than that. But he sounded good. He was a salesman, and it worked. So what happens is a lot of people like the easy way out. But we got to remember that we must follow something. And one of our standards has always been the good book of the Bible.
Thank you. Alan, your take on Gnosticism and anything Dennis might have said? Or anything you want?
If I could read from a quote from my earlier book, The Noahide Code, this is a quote sure. from an author named Hans Jonas, who wrote a very, very excellent book on Gnosticism. He's first, all the phenomena which we noted in connection with the Oriental Wave, which is Gnosticism, are of a decidedly religious nature. And this, as we have repeatedly stated, is the prominent characteristic of the second phase of Hellenism, culture in general. Hellenistic culture in general, sorry. Second, all these currents have in the same way to do with the salvation. The general religion of the period is a religion of salvation. In other words, the emphasis is on salvation. Third, all of them exhibit an exceedingly transcendent, that is, transmundane, conception of God, and in connection with it, an equally transcendent and otherworldly idea of the God, of the goal of salvation. Finally, they maintain a radical dualism in the realm of being and the world, spirit and matter, soul and body, light and darkness, good and evil, life and death, and consequently an extreme polarization of existence of affecting not only man, but reality as a whole. The general religion of the period is a dualistic, transcendent religion of salvation. And that's pretty much a description of what Christianity is.
Okay.
Well, salvation fits into a bunch of different things, but salvation is only one part of life. It is not what you live for unless you believe that you are in sin, unless you are saved. So therefore, you're bad when you're born because you haven't saved yourself. So this is I agree partially with what Alan said, because there's a duplicity involved here. In other words, if you're so busy worrying about saving yourself and you didn't do anything wrong, then what's your objective?
Well, the point is that salvation is a major focus of Gnosticism. It is a major focus of Christianity. I mean, that's all you hear. You know, you must believe to be saved. That is one of the main focuses, if not the main focus, of Christian and Gnostic teaching.
Gentlemen, I'd like to go now into Alan's book, because this is going to give a perspective where Gnosticism fueled more than just what was discussed here. And again, we're now at the bottom of page 139, and it goes something like this. The influence of Gnosticism went far beyond religion in how we look at the Bible. Gnosticism has had a far-reaching effect on Western thought, but because of Christianity's reluctance to study Gnosticism, these effects have been overlooked. From Paul's teaching about quote-unquote law versus grace in his epistles, through Chrysostom's 8 sermons against the Jews, Augustine and Aquinas to Martin Luther's exhorting Germans to, quote-unquote, set fire to their synagogues and raise and destroy their houses. And there's a footnote, number 15, where Alan writes the following. It is no longer fashionable, and this is quoting from Convitz's Torah and Constitution, it is no longer fashionable to avow a belief in Satan or his entourage of evil archons, but the fact is nevertheless that we are dualists. We have divided the world between God and ourselves, part of which consider our own, we are willing to turn over to Caesar. But believing in civil liberties, part we retain as our private domain. Some are willing to share part of this domain with God, but some are very jealous of their privacy and exclude him from it. They divide the world only between themselves and Caesar. The dualist is either a total or partial atheist. If he totally excludes God, then obviously he is an atheist. If he excludes God from the substantial part of the world, then to this degree, he is an atheist as well. Now, that's Convitz's Torah and Constitution. Now, going further into Alan's book, where, again, Martin Luther, not exactly my favorite human being in the history of the human family experience, although there was a Martin Luther King, Dr. Martin Luther King, who is. So Martin Luther King exhorting Germans to, quote-unquote, set fire to their synagogues and raise and destroy their houses, the Gnostic war in Judaism raged on. During the Enlightenment, the Gnostic teaching of its binary system of quote-unquote spiritual and then fleshy helped foster the division of religious and secular. And actually, I made a mistake. Footnote 15 was really from Martin Luther's On the Jews and Their Lies, 1543. So that's over 500 years ago. And what I read was actually from footnote 16 from Convitz's Torah and Torah and Constitution by Convitz. So this whole idea of fostering division of religious and secular, the concept of separation state as well as the Gnostic, Christian, fleshy, and spiritual had roots in the same Greek philosophy, which also influenced scholars such as Thomas Jefferson and Immanuel Kant. And there Alan quotes from Leonard Krieger, Kant and the Crisis of Natural Law, Journal of History of Ideas, Volume 26, Number 2, April to June 1965, page 195, where the following is recorded. Kant's notorious so-called dualism was a classic statement invalidating, among other things, the traditional function of the natural law. This is hardly surprising since his inspirations were Hume from his theory of knowledge and Rousseau for his ethics. The Hume denied the descriptive validity of the law in nature, and Rousseau, who had rejected the prescriptive validity of any intellectually known law for human action. Kant combined these piecemeal insights into a radical and systematic dialectic, opposing knowledge to action and nature to morality, and undermining thereby the very foundations of the natural law as it had been previously conceived. Then further going on, the fight against the Torah, however, subtly moved into new secular battlefields. And again, here's a footnote from Alan Stephen B. Smith, Spinoza, Liberalism, and the Question of Jewish Identity, published by Yale University Press in 1997 in New Haven, page 1. Secularization theorists confidently averred that religious conflicts, along with their attendant tribal and ethnic animosities, would wither away with the advance of modernity. Social and economic development would bring the conditions for stable democratic government, and with democracy, society would be liberated from the dominance of religious symbols and institutions. So the fight against Torah, however, subtly moved into new secular battlefields and developing secular academic disciplines such as history, philosophy, and sociology all took up the theological sword of Gnostic interpretation to do battle with the Torah of Moses.
Yes, well, I wish everybody else could clearly create that definition definition and detail separation that Alan does in his book. Most of the people I've ever dealt with in the world managed to wiggle between both of those ideas. And it seems like you can't pin them down because they're very wishy-washy. So they don't want to make a stand, and they want all the wiggle room that they can get. So when Alan comes out, that's clearly defined A and B, columns A and B, most people say, well, I like some of A, I like some of B. And they don't understand that you cannot live in a paradox world, but they do. Just like we have people who say they're fighting for the right of life, but yet they want to kill the people who actually do the abortions. So
yeah,
what
that
is the right of if you're willing to kill?
Yeah, that's a very big contradiction to want to preserve life, and yet acting as a vigilant.
The paradox we live in today, where people
right.
don't want to follow, as Alan said, well, this is how it is, and you're in column A or column B, and you can't go around mix-moshing all over the place. In other words, you can't make a salad out of everything. But some people think, oh, well, I can pick 2 from column A and 3 from column B, and I'm okay with that because it satisfies me either way I want to go. But that's the problem. We don't have people going back to the source where it's clearly defined and explained. They think you can rationalize everything. You cannot rationalize God. God is.
Alan, your take on these matters.
Well, this is talking about the binary logic of the dualism that I mentioned earlier, you know, the spiritual versus the fleshy, and this is what has separated our society. You have the secular, you know, oh, it's all about science and the physical world, you know, the fleshy, and then you have the religious, you know, mainly Christians, since they're the majority religion, talking
mm-hmm.
about, you know, no, it has to do with spiritual matters. And, you know, to go back to a quote I had earlier in the book by Rabbi Steinsaltz, talking about that there's no inherent difference between someone selling a car under, you know, going by Torah guidelines and someone keeping Shabbat. You know, it all is equally as important from a so-called religious standpoint. But that viewpoint has been separated in our culture, mainly because of our reliance on this theology that we've grown up with, that there's a wall of separation between church and state. According to the Torah, there is no wall. There's no, you cannot separate the duties according to what Hashem says you're supposed to do with a, you know, what you might think is secular, you know, like running a business and going to a house of worship.
But let's put it this way. You can't say the even days are moral and the uneven days are immoral. Morality has no boundaries that you can put onto it. It exists. It's there. You know what's right and wrong. Therefore, morality should be every day. And some people don't think that that's, they're falling under that group. In other words, let's say, just for instance, take Christians. Do Christians really know what they're supposed to be doing to be Christians? Well, I got news for you. They're like other people. And they say, yeah, on some days I feel like it and some days I don't. And that's why you have all these different branches of Judaism even that will say, well, we don't have to be strict because if we rethink it, we can change it to our thinking. No, it was defined a long time ago, and what is moral and immoral is clear. And you don't make choices or create a laundry list for what you want to do. If all your clothes are dirty, you don't say, I want only these ones to wash, and I'll let the other ones sit there. Well, what? Either you're doing the wash or you're not.
Gentlemen, I just want to end with one more example of duality, which unfortunately has creeped into, and I don't want to really go into the and I want to politicize the elections, but duality appears to me when you contrast what is written in the Declaration of Independence and a statement I heard recently during the debate. Let me just go into what's written here so succinctly from the Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Let's focus on the idea that men are created, including women, and they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among them these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And yet, I've heard one of the candidates during the debate saying, or actually not during the debate, but in a separate interview, that before a human being is born, they do not have any constitutional rights. Therefore, the parents, or the mother in particular, have the right to end their life, which would seem to be an absolute, from the constitutional perspective, an undermining of these self-evident truths that people are all that men are created equal. First of all, a human being is not, as a baby, is not created out of spontaneous generation, and they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that is, to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But if a child's life is cut down before they leave the womb, it seems that the interpretation of the Constitution is undermining that was supposed to be a self-evident truth, that people are created, number one, and they had to start from somewhere, even before we see them come out of the womb, and they have the unalienable right that is of life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. Then it's this duality that has crept in, unfortunately, to this political atmosphere, which is pretty poisonous, if you ask me, quite frankly, and how we can make sense of all this.
Well, again, here we go on with these paradoxes that are created by humans. God didn't create paradoxes. He said everything is clear. He even gave us the Bible to help us with it, even though he gave us free will and a conscience so we would know the difference between right and wrong. But the paradox is that you can say these nice things that are directed, that you just mentioned, about citizens of the United States. But what is missing is the definition of life. When does it begin? When does it end? It's not very clear in the statement you said regarding the documents of what the country was founded on, because we're taking it from the human side and excluding the spiritual side. And we're also, to me, we're excluding the scientific side. When does life begin? Because you can't say at birth, because we do know there's a gestation period of 9 months. And in that
right.
9 months, everything is being formed. Now, even though you can't use everything when the baby is born, does that make the baby any less of life than an adult? So we have this paradox that, oh, well, if they're too young, it really doesn't count, but it does count if they're adults. So now all of a sudden we get it back. We keep going into another paradox. If you can't define the what you're talking about, how can you make sense of some of this? So you can add nice words that sound good and even enlightened, but if you're forgetting what's behind the words, are you really using the words for the right purpose?
Beautiful. Alan, you're taking this how there's dualism or contradiction or paradox, the idea of unalienable rights for a person that was created, and obviously there's a creation process inside the womb, and then all of a sudden, boom, according to the Constitution, the person has no rights, meaning even they cannot protest, and the mother has the right to end the life of another life a week even before she's ready to give birth. Your take on this one? It's a very serious, sobering matter.
Well, first, you have to understand that the Declaration of Independence is not a legal document. It was mainly a list of complaints against King George as to
okay.
why the United States wanted to form its own government. And also, you know, the words all men are created equal. If you look at the Constitution when it was originally written, these obviously all men were not created equal because it excluded women, it excluded Native Americans, it excluded people of mm-hmm. color, it excluded poor people. You know, if you didn't own land at that time, you could not vote. There was a lot, you know, there was a lot of problems with this. You know, we interpret the verse a lot differently than in the spirit it was originally written. You know, as far as the issue of abortion, those kind of, you know, the rights of a child, you know, mm-hmm. that's something that has developed over time, over the last, really just the past 100 years, mainly. All life in Judaism is precious, even a child born blind or with a club foot. You know, back in ancient
mm-hmm.
Greece and Rome, they would put these children to death. Oh, they're defective. We'll just throw them down a well or leave them out in the woods to be devoured by animals. It was Israel that taught the world that every life is important, because the vast majority of cultures back then did not treat all life as equal or precious. Even in Native American, you know, this is one of the things about Native American culture. I guess, you know, when a elderly couple, when the husband dies, the widow is kicked out, and the goods of the husband and wife are divided up among everyone else. That's certainly not the way the Torah teaches you should treat the elderly.
Don?
Sure. Yes, Dennis.
Well, here we come to the paradox again. Here we have this statement by humans, for humans, about what they're entitled to and how to use life. Yet, all their species that they created, they stamped in God we trust. Yet, they didn't use the spiritual concepts in the statements in the Constitution, per se. You have the right, but that's one human giving the right to another. They left out the part of where in God we trust fits into that. So we have a dichotomy again, or a paradox, that we believe in God, but we practice in humans. Well, if you believe in God so much, and he created all the humans, how can you exclude him from the so-called sacred documents that our country was founded on?
Thank you. Gentlemen, we've actually reached the point where I'm going to have to wish both of you my gratitude for coming on tonight. You know, we're starting because of my work schedule changing a little bit. Hopefully we'll be having this class program on a regular basis on Wednesday night, hopefully a little bit earlier. Tonight a little bit later. I'll be contacting you, hopefully both of you, in over the next week to do another program, because yeah, we didn't cover so much of the book, but we covered so much information, and that I'm really looking forward to hearing feedback from our listening audience from around the world, their feedback on tonight's program. And as always, I thank both of you, Dennis and Alan. Alan and Dennis, for using one of your most precious of your commodities, your precious time. And with that being said, I'd like to offer you both gentlemen one last concluding statement before we sign off with a little bit of a cappella music. Dennis.
Last week, or the last couple of days ago, I heard the words from Alan as you were ending the program. And he said, well, I hope the UN will pick up this concept or idea and discuss it. Well, I couldn't agree with Alan more, but I've been waiting 15, 20 years for the UN to speak about things that are really in the mainstream and not pussyfooting around peripheral ideas when they were created for their mission to help the causes of man so that we have a better life.
Thank you, Dennis. Alan?
Well, not really much of a final word, but just to reiterate the understanding the concept of this binary logic of the Gnostic thought that we have in our society, that there is a wall of separation between church and state. Well, you know, when they says churches, they're talking about religion. And from the Jewish standpoint, there is no wall. There is no difference between secular duties and religious duties.
Right. They're just human duties. That being said, Alan, thank you again. And thank you, Dennis. Blessed souls, we're going to conclude with an a cappella rendition of When You Believe by the Maccabees, a bunch of young, ambitious, and very entertaining young men from who are, I would imagine every member of this group probably graduated from Yeshiva University, which is located by the George Washington Bridge over here in Manhattan. And as well, I'd like to remind everyone, you've got to do good. Dennis has to do good. Alan has to do good. I for sure have to do good. Anyone listening to this archive version has to do good, because you have good embedded in you. Because Ateva Tov Lehetiv, it is the nature of the good to do good, and that's coming from the Creator. And the Creator has decreed that you be here on the earth at this very moment as you're listening to this archive version. So that empowers you to go and do so. Do good. And I just want to mention, whatever is going to be the outcome of the elections, I am fully confident that if people around the world will realize that the Creator is waiting for all of us to increase in goodness and kindness, regardless of the outcome of the elections, although there's some people who will be sour and dour about whoever wins or whoever loses, good shall triumph over evil. And when you believe that, it will be a better world. And here's a song by the Maccabees that they'll perform for us right now, When You Believe. Take care, everyone. It's dark.
Ashira, Ashira, Ashira.